Between grief and nothing, I'll take grief. Not like we have much of a choice. This is Cinemaville. Today, we reach number 39 on the Wonders in the Dark sci-fi movie countdown, with George Lucas's debut masterpiece, THX-1138. I'll discuss it with Wonders regular James Euler, but first we have to pay respects to another Wonders regular. Scratch that. One of the founders, and the singular voice of Wonders in the Dark. A writer who devoted much of his life to the pursuit of studying and appreciating cinema. Alan Fish has recently passed away at the age of 43, and it is a massive understatement to say he will be missed. His soulful but succinct capsule reviews on classics both well and barely known will be missed. His idiosyncratic tastes, which could include everything from obscure Japanese new wave features and pioneering French silence to Lord of the Rings and anime, will be missed. Even the blistering keyboard fights he set off will be missed, because more than anything, what he helped inspire in others was a love of the movies. And if you were so moved to face off against him in debate, you were not only asking for trouble with a mind that could easily wipe the floor with you, but you were also falling right under his cinematic spell. And even if you wound up spending more time arguing with him than anything else, it only made the moments where you agreed all the more precious. Early on, my own time at Wonders, Alan and I found ourselves by sheer coincidence of taste, writing twin essays on Michael Cimino's underrated classic, Heaven's Gate, which he cited as the best film of the 1980s. It was one of the only times he and I ever saw eye to eye on anything. But for that alone, it makes me wish that I'd gotten to see him face to face. He leaves behind a treasure of critical output and a community of cinephiles as devoted and cantankerous as any American family feuding over party lines across the dinner table on Thanksgiving. He's a man who went to Orson's bosom if ever a man went to Orson's bosom. For more thoughts on our departed friend, here's fellow Wonders contributor Joel Bacco.
Hello, this is Joel Bacco. I'm here at the invitation of Bob to talk about Alan Fish. Alan, unfortunately, passed away this week, yesterday at the time that I'm recording this, and really can't exaggerate the impact that he had, certainly on me, and my online work, and, frankly, we literally wouldn't be here right now if it wasn't for Alan. I met Bob at Wonders in the Dark, the website that Alan wrote for and basically co-founded with Sam Giuliano. And it was Alan's Decades Countdowns that basically brought us and a lot of other people together. What he did is, starting in 2008, he would count down his favorite films, or what he considered the best films, and we could have a whole long discussion about that. There were a lot of discussions like that on Wonders in the Dark. But he listed his top films of each decade, started with, I think, 25 for the 1930s, and then by the time he got up to the 2000s, he was doing lists of 100. And, you know, it was in great demand. Everybody would wait. Each day a new one would go up. And the great thing about Alan was he would write very economically, but very evocatively. So he would review a film in probably two or three paragraphs. It was always, I think, you know, the equivalent of about a page. And somehow he would manage to sort of sum up the feeling of that film, just to kind of get you there, get you excited to see it if you hadn't, or get you wanting to watch it again if you had, or get you to appreciate something that maybe you thought, you know, you weren't that interested in. The best thing he would do would be to introduce you to things that you probably hadn't even heard of. Nobody that I know of had seen as many films as Alan Fish had. It's ridiculous. It's just like, you know, you can go to people like, you know, Jonathan Rosenbaum and these great film critics and writers who've seen all these films. Alan had seen almost certainly more than they had. He sought out films that, you know, weren't even available on DVD, and he would find, and as far as I know, you know, I don't want to, as far as I know, he didn't even torrent things. Like, he would actually go online and get physical copies of things and exchange, you know, talk to fellow cinephiles around the world. That's how he ended, you know, he was from Britain, and that's how he met Sam, who lives in New Jersey, and founded the website. Was through eBay. They were selling a DVD, I think, of Sancho the Bailiff. And they sort of connected and started exchanging lists and thoughts on different things. And, you know, it's just incredible the volume of film knowledge that he had and the way that he could write so deftly about it, you know. And I know I'm rambling a little bit here, and in a way that's sort of a bad tribute because he was so sort of economical and on point. But really, there's just so much to cover with him. So back in the day, starting in 2008, he'd do these decades countdowns. I think I came in around the 60s and Bob came in around the 80s. And, you know, the reviews would start the discussion and then it would just go crazy after that. We'd be having arguments, we'd be having debates, we'd be having agreements. Like, I had the most intense, crazy conversations on Wonders in the Dark under Alan's pieces, and he was always a big part of that. Alan absolutely was steadfast about his opinions and unflinching, take no prisoners in the way he would argue. And I tended to agree with probably a lot more of the takes. I think Bob and him clashed a lot on several things, but it was just fascinating to watch them sort of go back and forth. And it really actually helped build the website's audience even more, because people would come just to sort of hear not just what Alan thought about certain films, but how he would defend those decisions. And, you know, so that began about 6 or 7 years ago. And, you know, even after those countdowns ended, Alan would write these entries called the Fish Obscuros, where I think twice a week he would post about very rare films. And he introduced me to a lot of great films that way. The British TV film Son of Man, the Oshima film Death by Hanging. Those are just the first two that come to mind. But there were literally, I mean, hundreds of these over the years. And then also he did a weekly poll where he would poll everybody for their favorite films, would all participate. And that was a lot of fun too. But really, I think, you know, his great talent was just introducing a breadth of cinema and just the passion that he had for the idea of cinema as a whole. And that's something that I really personally connected with, because that's always how I saw it. As I saw the movies as this thing bigger than the individual movies, but also composed of it. And I know he did too. And you know, wherever he is now, you know, if that's even appropriate terminology to use, I don't know. I hope they've got a screening room. And if they don't, he'll make them build one. So, Alan Fish, we'll miss you, and thank you for your work. And it's going to give a lot of people inspiration and happiness in the future as well. The stuff that's online, when the book gets, he's got a book that's going to get published, either in e-form or hard copy, I'm not sure. But it's got basically thousands of these reviews. And just to close on this note, I mean, he made a list of his 3,000 favorite films ranked, and it was like hard for him to sort of narrow it down. So, you know, it's, when Alan passes away, a whole treasure trove of film knowledge and appreciation, but he also leaves a huge legacy behind. So, Alan, this one's for you.
And now, on to a lighter topic. Dystopia! The movie is THX-1138, and I have to admit, it's one of my favorites. A technical note for this conversation, this talk was recorded over the phone while driving on the highway and strolling through a shopping mall, just to give it a little bit of the same audio flavor as Lucas's movie. And also because I needed to run some errands. Mostly the errands. Let's go.
Picture show in the back row. To the late night double feature picture show.
Let's see, when did you watch THX again recently?
Well, I watched it I guess probably 2 weeks ago, maybe, and then I watched almost all of the original cuts that I have.
Okay.
I kind of fast-forwarded through some parts, so I kind of watched it almost twice in the last probably 2 weeks. So.
Mm-hmm. Any other major differences that you saw that weren't accounted for in some of the other things? Because, like, I know a lot of, like, the deleted scene or, like, the CGI edition scene compilations, they really only mention the really obvious changes.
Yeah, I mean, overall, as I kind of said, since the riff that I have of the new director's cut was like the Blu-ray, like, I was able to, you're very able, it's really plain to see, like, what is it, you know, you can see the 2004 CGI, you know, so it's very, there's more that's not touched, I guess. It's almost like a new film.
Yeah. You
know?
Yeah.
So, but I don't think it actually changes that much. You know, it just embellishes certain things and
right.
Stops, as we kind of discussed already. Well, the changes like that I was really that I would have never noticed it because it. I wouldn't have taken it as a CGI thing, but the
right.
Link you kind of detailed them all. So the bicycle or the motorbike sequence, where some of the shots he just like reversed them.
Oh yeah, that's really interesting to me because that's something that like he's done on a number of like films and shows that he's been involved in, where you know he'll shoot things one way and then at the last minute decide, you know what, I like the flow better right to left. Rather than left to right.
Yeah, and I was almost thinking that that's what he was doing. So that was one sequence that I watched recently. I just watched that because I was trying to figure out why. You know, so I was thinking that he was trying to have your eye, you know, do something like left to right bouncing with the touch or something. But the fact that he reversed like the whole sequence.
Yeah.
Like, even like the reverse shots are reversed, so it's almost like everything that was left went right. You know, so you're not actually really messing with like the rhythm or the eye play of the scene. You're just reversing the
polarity.
And some of the shots he did reverse them, then he extended some of the foreground. So it's like okay, I could just kind of see you could have like theoretically done that if you left the same, but. You know, I think later on when the motorcycle crashes, I think there is some kind of payoff to some of his madness of the reversing. But
right.
But it's really I think you're saying it's just it's really there's some really obsessive things going on, and I think that's interesting on a level like this.
Yeah. The other thing that I noticed when watching like this movie, in like you know again the. George Lucas director's cut, which is, I guess, basically a category all of its own right now. The one, like, the changes that stick out to me, the ones that are kind of, like, aesthetically offensive to me, are not just because, like, you have CGI. I don't really mind that. It's when you have a change that's done to, like, say, the camera work of the movie. Like, say, very early on in the movie, there's an extra shot of the factory that THX works in, and it and it's a crane shot. It's like a digital crane shot. That change bothers me because I look at that and I think, okay, there's no other crane shots in this movie. That doesn't fit the aesthetic of the rest of the movie. And yet, you also have shots that are like a long shot of the factory floor. You know, it does the same speed line composition where you have like the perspective lines extending to a vanishing point that fits completely with the aesthetic that he has throughout the rest of that movie. If he had, if all of the additions were in that vein, I would look at that and think, okay, this is, you know, perfectly fine. It's just those little, it's just those little bits where you have a camera move that is not only impossible in 1970, but is the type of thing that 1970 George Lucas wouldn't have done. Then it kind of rubs you the wrong way. But thankfully, most of it isn't really like that.
Yeah, and you have the rest of the film, as you're saying, to kind of back that up, that his visual sense, he wasn't shooting things in that manner. And because I think he's probably adding a scope to the factory, and I think some of the other additions, like the blow up scene, where you see how dangerous it is, this work that these guys are doing, I think that scene, he has an explosion, he clarifies with, the dragging out of the two bodies. I think that is really good, and I think it kind of, in a way, does what that crane shot he thinks he's doing. You know, so
I think it's
really superfluous. Yeah. Well, and I would also be curious to know, because I tried today and yesterday, because I knew I wasn't going to rewatch the film, to try and get some of the contemporary takes on the movie. There were a lot back then, because it wasn't screened a whole lot. So it was mostly people reacting to the director's cut, the re-release in 77 after Star Wars had hit, and so one I found was interesting was, Jonathan Rosenbaum, he liked the movie, and he said he saw it twice in 71. And one thing that he really was struck by the white on white composition that he said, which is true, you have these white sides. And some of the scenes you're talking about in the beginning, especially, he's kind of adding a lot of background to, I think they make prettier compositions in a lot of places, but it kind of does take away from that white on white,
So
I'd be interested to see, but I haven't seen anyone that liked a lot of that, minimalist look, talk about the movie.
Yeah, it definitely does get a little bit in the way of the integrity of thinking that this whole thing was shot on the fly of its pants by, kids who were essentially just barely getting permission to shoot in certain areas and the BART tunnels and the Marin County place. In some cases, they make it close to an aesthetically perfect experience, but you do lose something in making it like that.
What I've always liked about it is the alpha bill of it. You're taking it, just as you said, the San Francisco, and you're making it look like a futuristic city with nothing but good locations about it.
And it is interesting to see just how much they were able to get away with and how much big entities like city governments and corporations like Pacific Bell were willing to cooperate with a small indie production back then. That whole sequence where they're it's the most Alphaville looking part of the movie, where they're in the relay center for Pacific Bell. They talked about on the commentary. That's a location it's really cool to look at. It gives you both a period sensibility, because I think there's a similar scene in a place like that in 3 Days of the Condor, where Robert Redford is doing really old school hacking. But it's really weird to see that as one, something that's giving you a pretty convincing picture of a future infrastructure, but also one that is you know, not just of its time, but even at that time, like, they were able to get away with shooting there because that place was just about to be closed down. So,
yeah, right, right.
Yeah, so even yeah. then, like, it's, you know, a picture of a fading future.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, 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 that's a good point. There's a lot of those 70s movies that have, they have this, like, really dated quality to them. You know, because, like you're saying, this technology is so old or it's of the time. But it ends up looking so, like, techno-futuristic in a weird way.
Yeah.
THX was really at the cusp of that. And so it was, like, you know, something like, I think, Clockwork Orange hits that. But I mean, even some films that aren't trying to be, like, super futuristic, like you said, you know, Three Days in a Condor, or I just rewatched Parallax of You, and, you know, all the, you know, the building where Warren Beatty has to check in, you know, I just recall, like, the kind of, when you go outside, it has, like, this, like, glass panel that kind of, like, U-shaped into the ground, and it has almost like this peaks and valleys. It's totally like a 70s like thing, you know.
Oh yeah,
it
absolutely.
Would, you know, look really grungy today, but it ends up, you know, 30 or 40 years on, it ends up looking like this weirdo building, you know, in the future. So it's, yeah, I like that aesthetic. And
oh yeah, absolutely. Like, the 70s are a great time for getting that kind of, like, the plastic qualities of future aesthetic, because, like, that's also something that you see all over in World on a Wire.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, that film's, like, partially about that, I think.
Right.
You know?
You know, one thing that was interesting when I was looking at this with an eye for, like, what was changed and what wasn't changed, from the moment that he's arrested to the moment that the three of them break out, during that whole sequence, I think the only changes in the movie are, like, they, like, tried to, like, digitally erase any trace of, like, walls or corners in the white prison.
But yeah, but one thing about that when they're in prison, that white scene that lasts, you know, for, you know, a decent chunk of the movie, the merch commentary, he talks about, and I've always looked for it, and I've never been able to hear it, but he talks about how he tried to insert, like storm sounds, like because, you know, he thought that, you know, if this was shown as like a drive-in, that white would get scratched up.
And oh, yeah.
Eventually, after 30 or 40 viewings, it would be all black, and there would be, like, you know, it would look like there's a storm happening. So he kind of tried to be cheeky and act. But I've never heard any sound effects, so I don't know if they were taken out or what, but I've never heard them.
I think
the commentary, he's, like, talking about them, and I'm like, I don't hear them.
I think it's just, like, very slight, like, ambient stuff. It's
okay.
Yeah, it's something that I always notice, but it's just, like, a kind of low rumbling throughout. Yeah, the merch commentary, if you can ever get your head, like, I'm surprised, yeah, merch's observations are really great. I almost wish that there was a whole commentary just for him and just for Lucas, because a lot of the stuff that he gets into are, like, his observations on the way that music affects the listener on a movie and the way that sound effects affects you on completely different levels is a very, like, it's a very interesting observation on his point. And it's the sort of thing that makes it, like, even if you don't like this movie, it's kind of essential listening if you want to learn just about some of the really underrated aspects of filmmaking.
Yeah. When you're, things that are so, like, subliminal almost that you don't even kind of get, but when there's a real craftsman or a master. Well, I think the overall use of music was, that was one thing I wrote in my notebook to talk about it. It was a surprise. I hadn't remembered all these, like, you know, classical pieces that are interwoven throughout.
Right.
And that was a really, I think, a really, really positive of the film.
Yeah, it's interesting. Apparently, it's interesting to hear where the musical sources are, like, for one thing, it's kind of cool just to have, like, this whole movie scored in a very abstract, experimental way by Lalo Schifrin, especially when, like, if anybody knows about him here, all they're going to know about him from is, you know, Mission Impossible, and that's basically it. Whereas...
Did he make the show, or...?
What? Yeah, he did. Yeah,
the show? Oh,
yeah, that's
wow,
what,
okay.
Yeah, that's what he did, and he's done other things here and there. In fact, he might even still be alive. I'm not sure. But to listen to the score here, it's very, you know, it's very abstract. It's very kind of 70s art chic. Mm-hmm. You know, the flute trilling all the time.
Yeah,
but, like,
yeah.
I think you have, like, Tibetan chants. You have, like, Gregorian chants mixed in some places. But my
favorite,
but my favorite source for some of the music here in the movie is, you know, the shopping mall music is like they took a very small piece of music from like this very, I guess by now kind of obscure Warner Brothers movie called Miracle in the Rain.
Okay.
And, yeah, and it's like it's really weird. I did everything I could to track down this movie, Miracle in the Rain, and actually wound up finding exactly that bit of music. And it's weird. Yeah, like, you know, that just, that music that starts when you see everybody going up the escalator, that's from this other movie that I think has Frederick Martins or something. And it's just so, it's just so weird to hear it so randomly in the middle of this other scene. Black and white movie.
Yeah. More fun seeing it with somebody. I'm going shopping at noon. There's a food sale on at Macy's. Maybe I won't go either. Paper says rain. Morning. Morning. What do you people do, sleep in this place? The boss in yet? Mr. Jelinek has not yet arrived, Millie.
As if she didn't know it.
Are you still here? I told you to get the stamps.
Well, it's about time this one-horse company broke down and bought a mailing machine.
I could have had another cup of coffee. Believe you me, I need it.
Cool.
Just 4 hours
sleep. Seeing it as I did, at the age that I did in school, I've always kind of wondered if I don't partially, a lot of my feelings are drawn just because of the overly designed nature of it.
Mm.
And then seeing all the digital changes when you sent me that link and seeing just how many of them were just purely compositional. He's just strengthening compositions. He's making a more attractive, like, color field, you know, with his color tweaks and stuff.
Right.
I've often wondered if that was why I loved it, because I don't really recall what it was about that much when I first saw it. When I try and think back of what my impressions were. I remember, like, how it concluded, but I remembered almost all, like, purely, like, design touches, or I remembered the title sequence. I remember things like that. I didn't really remember, you know, so, like, this most recent scene, the most recent revisit I had, you know, like, I was picking up things with, like, the race, you know, issues and the sexuality and the things like that I had just kind of just disregarded or not even really paid that much attention, because they're not that hard to grasp, I don't think.
Right.
So I wonder if I would have, saw it when you did, you know, at an earlier age and I think it still would have been striking, you know, as we've already talked about. I mean, in some ways, it would just would have looked more minimal, you know, it would have been.
It was a good time for me because, like, that was, like, around the age that I was starting to kind of get bored with the first three Star Wars movies to begin with.
Okay.
So I was, like, at that point, I was starting to look at, like, Kurosawa and Godard movies. And oddly enough, the movie that I thought of the most when I was watching it this most recent time was Point Blank. You know, there's a lot, you know, partly because they're both, like, super widescreen of that era. They both have, like, similar-sounding scores. It's not, like, mm-hmm. you know, that one isn't Lalo Schifrin, but it's, you know, it's kind of on the same spectrum as him. And I don't know if it's Borman that you can account this for, or it's, like, the guy who was doing the cinematography for him. I can't remember the guy's name, but he did, like, all the early Pink Panther movies, which have an oddly really great use of widescreen. But just like if you just like watch the walking sequence from Point Blank, you will see a lot of like the same like genetic material as THX. You've got like very heavy use of like perspective line composition, a very kind of elliptical editing pattern, and it, you know, it's just really interesting looking at it from that perspective. Like, whenever I see people, like, accusing THX as, like, stealing from, I don't know, you know, stealing from 2001 or stealing from, you know, Passion of Joan of Arc or whatever, I always think to myself, no, it's not really stealing from those. It's stealing from Metropolis, and it's stealing from Point Blank, if it's stealing from anything.
Yeah. This most recent watch, I hadn't seen it since I had seen that. I don't know if you've ever seen, it's kind of obscure, but Alan turned me on to it. This movie called Mandara. It's like a new wave Japanese movie. But it's like a real, like, nihilistic, like, kind of Buddhist movie. But there's a full sequence in the middle where they're on, like, a white soundstage. And there's these people. But what's interesting is it came out in 1971, so there's not this person, you know, they came out the same year. And there's no way that if one came out, you know, before, that they would have been able to see it because they were both, you know, pretty obscure.
Right. It's just something floating in the air.
Yeah. And the fact that I think the white sequence in both movies kind of happens kind of centrally, and it kind of takes up a large portion of the movie. Like, they're kind of inserted in very much the same way. And the films, I think, they're both pretty bleak, and so that you can compare them that way. But they're very much about different things, but they're very similar. And the fact that they came out the same year, I mean, it's pretty crazy.
I really want to look at this. I think that the thing that both of those things might be drawing on, and maybe this just makes sense because they're both sort of the same period, but, like, Theater of the Absurd is probably something that influences both of them.
Definitely.
Yeah. But I'm also thinking, like, the way that certain things are framed in this movie, I really have to, like, find a copy of it and watch it again. But another thing that, like, Alan turned everybody on to was Eros Plus Massacre. A great movie, but a nightmare to watch in, like, a subtitled version in English, because almost all of the subtitles in that movie that I remember, because of the way the movie is framed, all the subtitles are covering people's faces.
Oh, yeah.
Right. But that just shows how radically that movie is framed, basically putting everybody on the bottom of the screen and making a great use of the vertical space, which, I mean, I want to look into it a little deeper and see if that's, like, a uniquely Japanese thing, because, like, you notice if you look at, like, a lot of anime, like Evangelion, they do that same thing.
Because most people talk about Lucas and they're so concerned with his borrowing of, like, plot or you know, like what the Kurosawa mentioned. But it is interesting that most people miss his, because he's so visual, especially in his early films, in this earliest one, that you don't, because he's way more Japanese New Wave to me.
Yeah.
And I never really even heard him, you know, talk about, you know, like Yoshimas or you know, I don't, who knows if he's even seen any Yoshidas, I don't know. You know?
Yeah. So yeah, that's the interesting thing to me is between his digesting of French New Wave and, like, kind of classic Americanized Japanese cinema in terms of, like, Kurosawa and some other people, I wonder if somehow he was able to kind of, like, backwards engineer Japanese New Wave through that, which is, I mean, because, like, if, like, just judging by, like, what he talks about on the commentary, it's interesting. He talks about Breathless briefly. He never mentions Alphaville. And as much as I'd like to think that there are shout-outs to that movie, or that, you know, he could talk about the structure of that movie and how it influenced him, I would not be terribly surprised if he hadn't seen it.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the same count, you know, I would actually be really very surprised if he had seen much of the actual Japanese New Wave, simply because how much exposure did that stuff have until, like, maybe the later 70s or the 80s or something, I don't know.
Yeah, and then our new, like, you know, DVD, you know, internet era. Which I'd be curious, have you ever, I read today or yesterday that there was, like, a novelization of the movie. Have you ever read that?
No. I've always been curious to find it, though, because it's written by Ben Bova, who's a pretty well-regarded science fiction writer in his own right.
Okay.
And
they say in the book that there was an assertion of, like, after the love scene, Lowell goes and she speaks to, like, a government official that would be, like, a psychiatrist or a therapist or whatever, and she kind of confesses that she's done this.
and he directly goes and, you know, kind of says that, oh, there's someone who's, you know, been engaging in these, well, I can't remember what they call them in the film, like erotic perverse transgression. There's, I love the wording. And but so he basically turns her in, and then there's like a, there's more put into her capture and her eventual, you know, execution.
Hmm.
So it'd be interesting to get more of her, because I guess her execution in the book is through her perspective. Well, I was really, that shooting script mentioned, you had kind of been reading that, and I wanted to talk a little bit about, like, the race in the movie, because you had said that they're called, like, Negro mannequins, I think.
Right, which right.
I wonder if that's, like, more of a visual signifier, just to kind of say this is what the holograms are going to look like, or if it was more of, you know, because they are, you know, there are, like, African, you know, dancing, essentially, for, like, the facts of the movie.
Right. Well, it's interesting, like, I haven't gone through all of the scenes in that in the script yet, but it's interesting to see one big difference from the movie is apparently the holograms were going to be a bit more interactive. Like, there was, like, a scene where, like there's a scene in the script where, like, the two newsroom guys are going off, and, like, I think it's where they're talking about, like, the theater of noise and everything. And in that version of the scene in the script, what happens is, like, THX gets pissed off and he says, oh, that doesn't make any sense. And the hologram turns to him and says something. I have no idea what he says, but there is a moment where the hologram actually talks back to him. And it seems like he, you know, can actually hear him or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is interesting to me because, like, it touches on, like the whole telescreen thing from 1984. But it also feels very much like, I know that this movie probably came out. No. This would have come out after Truffaut's Fahrenheit, right?
Yeah. Was like 67, I think. 68.
Yeah. So, which would be interesting because I'm pretty sure this movie was shot and finished in 69. So that puts it like around the same period. I mean, it was like sat on the shelf for a little while.
Yeah. Well, and how much, because when was the student film made, too? That would have been, like,
65, I guess. But I don't remember.
Yeah, and
I have to be honest, I haven't watched the student film in a pretty long time. It's never...
Same here, yeah.
Yeah. Of all his student films, like, he has a lot of student films that are really interesting. The original THX isn't really one of them.
Okay, yeah. I remember thinking his best one when I was kind of obsessive about trying to watch student films, you know, 10 years ago. I remember that, like, generally his that were good, I thought, were ones that were purely just, like, fluff. Like, you know, just about nothing. He was able to just take something somewhat interesting and then make it, like, I remember the best one I thought was he went down to the racetrack and he filmed cars racing, and it was really visually dynamic and really exciting to watch.
Yeah.
And so I remember thinking that, but I don't remember the THX.
Yeah.
I remember thinking that it was just very, obviously it's a student film, so it can't be that thematically rich, but I remember thinking that a lot of the plot came later, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in that sense, that's one of, like, his purest exercises in just fast things going fast, which is, you know, for some reason, one of his big personal concerns.
Yeah, which is why, I mean, a lot, rewatching the prequels, those are generally always the scenes that I got the most out of, this rewatch. Like, so many people complain about, like, the pod racing scene in the first one, and I think it's the best sequence in the whole film. Which, I've always wanted him to make a movie, like, something as, like, relative fluff as, like, Le Mans, you know, with Steve McQueen. Like a George Lucas Le Mans would be great.
Oh, man, like... Do you know he was apparently one of the cameramen on Grand Prix?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is especially...
That's an exciting movie.
Yeah. I mean, I think he is. I think if you look at the credits to that movie, he's listed, and I want to believe that, especially because, like, apparently you go back and you look at the pod race, and you look at Grand Prix, it's, like, very closely modeled on that movie, and it's not often cited as one of his big...
Yeah.
things. I mean, I think Frankenheimer is a bigger... Frankenheimer isn't a huge influence on him, but where he is an influence is easy to spot.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, it's like that and, like, you know, if all you had was that and the way he shoots television sets and, like, vertical scan, that's enough to put quite a lot in, in there.
Yeah, no, that's true,
Yep, but I mean, like...
Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, I think, like, the big, like, I recently watched this movie and, you know, of course I watched The Phantom Menace earlier for the other, you know, for the beginning of the countdown.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing that, like, struck out to me the most as, like, a commonality between these two movies, besides the fact that you have, like, a few similar scenes where you have this impenetrable jargon that I think is there for a purpose, is they're both very, they're very primary-heavy movies.
Okay.
You know, in fact, it, you know, it's kind of interesting.
Which scene in Phantom Menace are you speaking of?
No, no, I just mean, like, very primary color-heavy. Like, the palette.
Oh, I got you. Okay. Okay, I got you.
Know,
yeah.
And what's, I mean, like, if you look at this movie, one of the first really, like, full shots that you have in THX is, like, the buttons lighting up. And sure enough, you have red buttons and, like, a blue button lighting up, a yellow button lighting up. It's like you're getting a traditional primary, just, like, scale showing up there. And then throughout the rest of the movie, like, when you go to the mall and you have, like, the, you know, shopping mall hexagon things, they're all primary and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and
those almost look like additions to, like, set too. I would wonder if those are, like, real.
What are you talking about? What
do you mean? Those are like all those color things in the mall sequence. I wondered if those were, like, something that they found that was, like, there in the actual real mall. They were, like, additions in the production. You know, like, they had somebody dress that stuff up.
That's an interesting question. They, either way, they really fit the aesthetic of the time really well.
That's why I would wonder,
Yeah, it does look like the sort of thing that they look like and say, yeah, we can get this in bulk and make our lives a little easier. But
And I would, to your point on primary colors, I would also say that for a movie that takes place, you know, at night, American Graffiti is a very primary color film, too.
Yeah, to an extent.
You know, hot rods being yellow or neon lights or signs being,
It's a little harder to see, I guess, sometimes because, like, you don't get the bright, like, the bright white or other bright colors to, like, stand off and really see them in relief quite as much. That's something that you definitely have in, like, Phantom Menace, which has a much, like, brighter palette and lighting than some of the other things.
There is a lot of brightly lit, you know, either outdoor shots or, you know, he's, you know, anytime you go to Queen Amidala's planet, you know, you get these, like, big waterfalls and everything.
Yeah.
And I do give him a little bit of credit because so often in, like, our big budget, you know, CGI fest now, everything is so dark.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like the old noir idea that you can, like, hide things, you know?
Yeah.
And he by and large, is, you know, trying to continue making a movie as he would normally do it. He's not trying to make any considerations for a largely CGI landscape, you know, so.
Yeah.
But I give him credit for that. I think that, you know, because everything is so dark and, you know, in our kind of mainstream, blind.
Yeah, either that or they're, like, very unremarkable. Like, I look at, like, I think of, like, there have been a couple of movies that I've enjoyed in the past, like, 5 years or so, like, one movie that I enjoyed very recently from a couple of years ago was, like, Cloud Atlas. And I enjoy, I enjoy the patterns of that movie, the rhythms of that movie. And it's not really a dark or dour movie in the same way that others are. But I have to say, I can't really remember much of the designs of that movie in the same way that I remember other things. Like, I can kind of remember, like, Future Babel, Tom Hanks, but that's it.
Yeah, I've never seen that. It's, like, it's on my list, but it's been on my list for 3 years, so.
Yeah. It's interesting because you can definitely see the Wachowskis doing more, like, slightly experimental stuff from, like, The Matrix to Speed Racer to Cloud Atlas, and then doing something really cool on Netflix with, like, Cloud 9 or, Sense8 or whatever the hell that is. and then completely...
Yeah, I've heard good things about that, yeah.
Yeah, and, yeah, but at the same time, like, they also completely botched things up with, like, Jupiter Ascending or whatever. And one of the big reasons why that movie didn't work for me is because they did not have a particularly good design sense for movies. Like, you look at that movie and you look at any, like, screen grab, just, like, still screen cap from the movie, it looks very striking. But once you put it into motion, everything, like, all the ships look like they have the same design. So when you have, like, an action scene where one ship is chasing the other, it becomes almost impossible to tell who's chasing who. And that's a problem you never have in, like, Lucas's movies or any number of other movies. You know which ship is the good guy ship and which one is the bad guy ship. Or even or even in THX, you know that THX is driving a car and the other guys are on bikes. Very simple.
And
that is one of the things that you can value here, like, and you can see it from the beginning of, like, Lucas's career, like, in THX. You'll have the big master shots and the perspective heavy shots during a chase, but you'll also have that weird mounted on the hood of the camera, on the hood of the car shot, looking at, like, THX just to kind of show you where, you know, his screwed up head is at the moment as he's trying to drive. And it's an insert, like, you know, he does a good job of balancing the master shot to give you, like, a map of the whole action scene, the set piece, and then putting you closer in. Whereas a lot of modern directors, unless they're working in IMAX, and for IMAX they will go longer, but if they're not doing that, it's mostly going to be a lot of close-ups, and it's going to be incomprehensible, and I guess that's the hill that a lot of them will go to die on and say, oh, well, it's an action scene. It shouldn't be understandable. You should be feeling, you know, like you're about to be killed any moment. And that does seem like a far cry from, I don't know, that shows you how far you've come from, you know, The Great Escape or something like that.
And I think that Lucas clearly liked action cinema his whole life. You know, from the war movies that he riffs on, you know.
Yeah.
To, you know, to you know, whatever, the serial. You know.
Yeah. And, like, you know, and Kurosawa, for his time, is a master at doing just that type of calm but really dynamic action. I mean, the big difference today is we have no more sense of calm. And if you do have a sense of calm, like, there is, like, you know, like, when I watched, like, I'm assuming you didn't go see Civil War.
No, the
yeah, the Marvel movie.
Captain America.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I did not.
Yeah. I saw that, and, you know, if you grew up liking these superheroes and you wanted to see them all fight or something, there's a bit of fun in that, but even then, it's very kind of unremarkable, just in the way it's staged and everything.
Which I know those, the Captain America movies are supposed to be the crown jewel of, like, people who try and say, these are actually good movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've never seen them, so I can't comment, but...
Yeah.
I don't have, like, an aversion to seeing them. Like, I saw the mess that was, you know, Batman vs. Superman, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and... Yeah, it's interesting to see how this whole genre is evolving and de-evolving at the same time. Like, I'd like to think that there's a lot of potential in the superhero genre. I just wish they weren't all controlled by two or three mega corporations.
Yeah, totally agree. And I hate that those mega corporations are now finance. I mean, if you like action cinema at all, like, which I think is the thing that really ties you and I appreciation kind of cinema together, would be, you know, that, and the fact that, you know, 8 out of 10 action movies that are given a decent budget nowadays are superhero films.
Yeah.
You know, which is, you know, just a shame to me, because I do like, you know, so it'll make me disproportionately, like, you know, look forward to the next Jack Reacher or something, or, you know, the next John Wick or something, you know, because I like that kind of cinema occasionally, especially at the theater, and it's like, I don't have a lot of choices anymore.
Yeah, I feel like the last movie that I was able to really look forward to in a like serious degree, like this summer I enjoyed the last X-Men movie because there's at least a director who's given a modicum of respect and distance to do what he wants, but even then, I don't care that much. Like, when I saw, like, Snowpiercer was a really impressive example to me of something that had a very clear sense of its own imagination and its own vision. And really, you know, it's florid in the right places, and it has it, you know, it has an internal consistency, you know, to speak of, like, George Lucas and his whole left-to-right thing, that entire movie is left-to-right in a very clean, neat way.
Yeah. Well, or something like I don't know if we ever talked about it. What were your thoughts on the most recent Mad Max movie that everyone went?
Oh, I thought it was really good. And the thing is, like, I like that movie for mostly the same reasons that I like the Star Wars prequels, is that you have a director sticking with their old property, mostly doing it the same way that he did before, just at a higher scale, at a higher sense of scope. And, you know, I was, you know, considering that the two of them have done about the same level of output over the years, I would more or less compare the two of them as being, I think that the two of them are very comparable filmmakers, especially, like, you look at some of the earlier Mad Max movies, he's definitely doing, like, some of the same Joseph Campbell things sometimes. Because I think even Miller had, like, his own brief experimental period, didn't he?
That I don't know. First Mad Max, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think he had a movie that I think is, like, the history of the world. Like, it's like a history of barbarism in the world or something, and it's very kind of breaking the fourth wall.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The other thing, of course, is George Miller also has an extended child-friendly period in his canon.
Yeah, the people that think, like, they pig in the city and...
What? Yeah.
And what was the other one he did around that time? He did another one, too.
Well, I know he did both of the Babe movies. I mean, he didn't direct the first one, but he did... Yeah, but I mean, the Penguin movies...
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, Happy Feet. Yeah. And speaking of, like, all the... And, like, to speak of, like, the potential that you have in the superhero genre, he at one point was attached to do, like, an animated Justice League movie.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah. And as happy as I am that he's just, like, doing his own thing now again, the idea of him getting to play with that sandbox of toys, that would have been really interesting.
Yeah. Well, and that's really the shame with these kind of directors who...
And over here.
I think what the Mad Max proved to me is sometimes I think a lot of these directors, they kind of fumble when they start trying to deal with story too much. And that's not... You know, I think the Kung Fu scenes and the prequels to me are the love scenes, you know, are the scenes in the meadow when they're rolling around, because... While I don't think they're as bad as I used to, I still think that they're just a little... They're kind of a notion of romance that he got from watching, like, a epic movie from the 60s or something.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, to an extent.
Or something like... Yeah, and so Al, what I liked most about Mad Max, and I'm surprised that a lot of people who didn't like it, I think that they were just mostly just kind of appealing to all the people that did like it, and it was kind of the inevitable backlash, but... How simple that movie was. It was just such a distillation of, like, just a nothing movie, and, you know, plot-wise, pretty much. And there was kind of things on the periphery, like subtext of, like, feminism and stuff, which I think were kind of overblown a little bit, when really it's just a movie, it's just, like, pure filmmaking, and just, you know, and I think it touches on why we were talking a little bit ago about, you know, if Lucas could make, like, a Le Mans movie or something like that, you know, would be really, really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and, like, that's one of the things that I think is interesting to me, the simplicity of it. Like, the reason why Fury Road works so well, especially, like, on, like, a feminist registry, is not the fact that it spends so much time trying to make a point that, you know, women are just as capable as men, it's because they take the time to have like a really well-made character like Furiosa. The reason why it works on that social level is because Furiosa is a cool character. People, you know, naturally want to do cosplay of her and stuff like that. And people are now wondering less when's the next Mad Max movie going to be, but when's the next Furiosa movie or whatever.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
like the character, it almost doesn't really matter what the character is fighting over. That's all just a matter of MacGuffins at a certain point.
Yeah, and I think that she's not, like, fully... I mean, she's fleshed out enough that you care about her and you have all these, you know, notions of maybe what she's standing for or whatever, but it's not to the point that, like, something like Kill Bill is supposed to be about, like, feminism, too, because then there's so much there that you're just like, this kind of doesn't hold up. It ends up just being, like, she's doing what a man can do. Just because she's a female doesn't make it like some sort of, you know, diatribe on feminism or something, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that Fury Road kind of is able to touch on that a little bit better because it's just so kind of vague or, or, you know, it gets to what it's doing and doesn't really, you know, fool around with any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's very plain spoken on that level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like I don't like the Transformers movies, but the third one, if you took, like, the final sequence, like, the climax of the movie, which is, in the scope, it's like an hour and 15 minutes, probably, the end, the last. If you just cut the previous whatever is before it and just sat down and watched the beginning of the climax and then final fight, it would be, like, a really cool movie, I think.
Hmm.
And I've always told people that, and they're like, what? And I'm like, if Michael Bay would just stop trying to, like, be cute and funny and have, you know, dumb, you know, models and... dumb dialogue between models and, you know, people like Shia, you know, just, you know, if he would just lose all that and just make a movie that's just purely, just, he wouldn't, you know, because I think it's pretty cool, like, for just action stuff, but, yeah.
It's interesting to look at this movie in the advent of, like, the whole, you know, YA dystopia sort of fanfare, like the Hunger Games and Divergent and all that stuff.
Yeah, I think the politics of the movie is interestingly ambiguous because it, you know, if you were like I can totally see it right when you're watching this movie and being like, oh, this is a parable about, you know, socialism gone crazy.
Right.
But I also, you know, it's, you know, and this is one thing I've always felt about the movie and I've never been able to, wanted to talk to you about is this idea that it's very clear about what consumerism is and what Lucas's take on consumerism is, and how that has, you know, how you now have to look at that under the guise of, you know, what he did with the commercialization and marketing of, you know, toys and other products for Star Wars. Like, I read what you know, if you have anything to say about that.
Well, the thing that interests me there is that, like, I guess with, like, the commercial aspect of, like, the Star Wars movies is he wasn't so much inventing anything that hadn't been done before, but was, like, taking full advantage and using it to, like, I just like, farm and benefit his side of the filmmaking system as much as possible. Like, before...
Like, almost like, I want to be a movie mogul... like Louis B. Mayer, not like a great director, or not be like a director that makes a bunch of films. I want to control the whole thing, and the only way I can amass this sort of fortune is doing this.
Right. It's like saying,
you know,
if I want, it's like if I want to be the Jacques Tourneur, I have to be the Val Wooten at the same time.
Yeah.
It's like, if you look at, like, other movies of the same type, you had examples of this happen, you know, quite a bit. Like, you had a lot of merchandise that was made for, like, Planet of the Apes and Disney, obviously.
Yeah.
And he was just smart enough to say, okay, you guys don't want the merchandising rights to this. I will take the merchandising rights. And that winds up bankrolling a whole lot of his movies. So, at the, like, like, at the most, I could look at that and say, okay, that's kind of a cynical gambit on his part, but one that paid off. And the only thing that, like, the only negative thing about that, I guess, is that no other filmmaker has ever really been able to get away with it since. Because...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, well, and I would say, like, watching the total onslaught that we saw with the last one via Disney, it could have been worse, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it seems restrained when you know, walk into a Target last December, and it's just, like, wall-to-wall everything. You know?
Yeah, and not only wall-to-wall everything, but, like, wall-to-wall everything from 40 years ago, at least.
That's what's interesting about these characters is that they could introduce, like, three new characters, and most of the merchandising is still mining Darth Vader. Like,
yeah.
You know, or Yoda. You know?
Right, all of it is mining Darth Vader, Yoda, but it's all, like, the same exact chips. It's all the same exact, you know, the TIE Fighters, the X-Wings, the Millennium Falcon...
Yeah.
And that's it. You know, that was one of the...
Go ahead, sorry.
No, it's right, thanks. That's one of the things
Watching THX and seeing, like, you know, essentially saying, like, you know, buy is like obey, you know. It's a stark...
Well, I guess there what is really being commented on is not so much, like... the consumerism that, like, Star Wars represented, but it's more the consumerism. What's really being commented on in, like, THX, I don't think it's so much the type of consumerism that you have in Star Wars, because as, like, it's easy to look at a lot of that and be cynical about it, but at the end of the day, people who are buying, like, Star Wars stuff are valuing it and appreciating it on some level. What's really being commented on, like, in THX is that kind of completely disposable, ignorant sort of consumerism where you buy something, you put it on a shelf, and you don't even think about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm also kind of thinking on, you know, because, yeah, when we've seen Star Wars, you know, being, you know, we're in America, so we're, you know, most of the objects were being sold as a consumer goods to buy or whatever. And yeah, they are. Like, some of them do have value, and some of them don't. But I'm more speaking of, you know, since THX is purely in a world that's like of a factory setting, you know, and you have the invitation by the end that they're underground. And they're almost underground with these, like, you know, time traveler H.G. Wells, like, Morlock.
Right.
So there is the understanding that above ground, I guess it would be like the advanced civilization that are enslaving these people.
Either that, or there is no civilization, and you're lucky if it's impossible to live.
Yeah, and that's like clearly, you know, hinted at that he could be, you know, just as worse off when he's up there. But I think that the fact that there's so much work being done, it has to be sustaining some sort of class, I would think. But so then that's what I would say, like. Not even like the consumerism that when you have that kind of what Disney onslaught at us with, if you were to go to a factory where all these goods are being made, you know, like Indochina or somewhere. You know, that's what you would see. You would see endless factories making, you know, goods that they're never really going to see, and to them would be, you know, pure nothing, you know.
Yeah.
And so I think that's, you know, if you kind of do a one-to-one correlation factory to factory, not where these goods are going to end up going, is kind of, you know, that's the point I would make that makes a lot of the, you know, kind of the stuff in the movie about buying and stuff and all of Lucas branding, you know, for the last 40 some years.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to me and why I've never been able to really like him. But it's weird seeing it kind of jive within the series concept of the movie.
Yeah, it's interesting for me to look at that too after seeing some of the similar factory scenes in the prequels where there's a bit of a self-awareness there, but it's somewhat divorced from the same type of metaphor that you had in THX. I guess like what you have in those movies is very much like a false flag, one army is building another army sort of thing, and it's like the logic of a Dr. Seuss fable or something.
Here
you have a little bit of that, where you have, like, all the stuff that they're building in the factory are the robots of their own oppression.
One thing going back to your army, you know, armies against, you know, like the one thing about the
the prequels is like the side we're rooting for the majority of them until, you know, kind of gets completely flipped on its head, is that they're using clones that are actual people, you know, theoretically.
Yeah.
They're genetically modified, but the other side is using like robots. So
yeah.
You could theoretically say, like, I wouldn't care about, you know, millions of robots made and destroyed or killed or whatever, but these are actual people in these helmets. So
yeah.
They're the good guys, so it is like a weird...
Yeah, and it forces you to question a lot of the morality on the side that's willing to accept this great big slave army, essentially.
But I don't want to discount what happens in real life. You know, like I don't doubt that George Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola, when they started, or you know, when they agreed, you know, that would have been a huge honor for George Lucas to be like, you know, this guy who I think. I've read that all the USC guys really respected Coppola because he kind of got out there. He started writing scripts. He started getting work. They all were like, oh, this guy's made it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So when he starts a production company, he selects you to be like, we're going to put all of our money behind you as our first big feature, you know?
Right.
Lucas would have been, you know, totally tickled at that. And then when it failed, I don't doubt that was just totally crushing. And he was just kind of like,
to be more responsible.
Be like, look, like, yeah, I'm going to do whatever it takes to not let this peril to my friends or people who bankroll my projects, or if I'm bankrolling myself, I'm not going to let this happen again. And
right.
I'm going to try and do whatever it takes to, so I don't doubt that he was able to say, look, I have all these beliefs, but I got to do what I have to do. And, you know, cause right away, even though it is sort of a sentimental, depressing-ish movie too, like American Graffiti goes immediately away from that kind of heavy, you know, more, you know, political back.
Yeah, yeah, it's a much more conventional mainstream type of movie, and hitting on, it's like aiming right for the jugular of nostalgia, right when it was just beginning to be born, the whole Happy Days sort of thing.
Yeah, and I actually read that. That's my least favorite of all his films, even as much as certain parts of the prequels, and I think it's his most cynical, because like you said, I think it's very just like clicking off, like, I mean, he's getting right at the baby boomers and like nostalgia, like, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I'm
the cottage industry. I mean, it's insane.
I'm very much in the same place that you are there. I mean, I saw it a few years ago in a theater, and I like the technical qualities of it, but at the end of the day, I do think it's probably odd to say for something that is apparently based on a lot of his teenage years, it might be his least personal movie. Like, even the Star Wars or the prequels or the Clone Wars even probably represents more of his blood and sweat on the page and on the screen than American Graffiti. That was his one for them, and everything else has been for him.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody's in movies. Doesn't matter who you are. There are stars.
And that's it for THX 1138, number 39 on the Wonders in the Dark Sci-Fi Countdown. Next time, we'll be covering my last feature for the countdown. And if any of you know me well, it will not come as a surprise. It certainly wouldn't come as a surprise to Alan Fish. Until then, this is Bob Clark for Cinemaville, saying, rest in peace.
In vain. Rudolph Salah.
such a long